My name is Cindy F. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since September 11th, 1994. My sponsor's name is Maureen H. And my home group is called the Paramount Group in Southern California. I'm really grateful for all those things. I wanted to start out by thanking Billy for asking me to speak. And I also wanted to say, I believe it is your 15th anniversary this month. Am I mistaken? Right? I think you guys are celebrating 15 years. If that's the case, then happy anniversary. Starting off kind of at the end, I am a proud member of my home group. I'm a founding member of my home group. I like what you guys just read. And I heard in an earlier meeting today, people talking about singleness of purpose. I know this is also this, oriented group that you guys do panels and practice all three sides of the triangle in this group. So I'm really honored and privileged to have been asked to speak at it. And, my home group is the same. And the way I help make sure that it stays that way is I continue to be an active member in my home group. I continue to be an active member at our district and area levels. And I continue to sponsor and to make sure that singleness of purpose is being practiced. To always do my part is be in my chair. And I try to sit in our Zoom meetings in the same way. I try to sit up front and put my picture on do everything I can to be an effective, this 10-step talks about, that I'm supposed to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And I don't believe that you can do those things for me personally without practicing all three sides of that triangle on a regular basis, without being perpetually in step work, like just continuing. I don't do one and done, take what I need and leave the rest in Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's not what was given to me when I got here in 1994. When I got here in 1994, I was 25 years old, but I looked like a 15-year-old. Everyone assumed I was a 15-year-old, and I got treated a lot like a kid. I had a lot of, old-timers around, mostly, kind of crusty old guys telling me they spilled more than I drank. And, fortunately for me, I'm a little bit of a defiant one, especially when I first got here. And so my reply to them spilling more than they drank was kind of like a, F you old man, sorry you spilled so much, grandpa, and I'm staying anyway. And I continued to try to make that work for me. I continued to try to be someone who was determined to do this no matter what. I was looking for a way to stay from the very beginning, not a reason to leave. And I don't know why that is, because it certainly isn't who I was. I will tell you like where I kind of came from, what it was like before, and you'll understand why I say that I am not someone who shows up to things and tries to stay and looks for reasons to be around. I'm a runner. I'm a failure to appear kind of person. I have been for as long as I can remember. When I was a kid, one of my first memories of, when I kind of knew that there was something in me that maybe wasn't quite right is this stupid third grade math test I took, and it was like a self-corrected third grade math test. And I got like a 99 on it, and I couldn't accept that. And so I erased the answer, cheated, and made it 100. And, I was born to these two people who, they're good people. They've been together since the seventh grade. They have never, carried a credit card balance from one month to the next. They got married right out of high school. They were not able to have children because of some unfortunate circumstances. And instead of blaming the world, drinking their lives into oblivion, burning their life down and running around like the biggest victims on the planet, which is what I would have done and did do eventually, they just adjusted their plan. And they went out and they adopted my older brother. And 5 years later, they adopted me. And then they raised us. Knowing we were adopted, there weren't a bunch of secrets. They raised us to be people who paid our own way, worked hard, earned what we had, the things we had, and we had everything we needed and most of what we wanted, but they raised us to appreciate those things. My dad saw to it that I knew how to be just as self-sufficient as humanly possible, that I could, fix anything and do anything at least to some degree. And I had all the makings of a really great childhood. You know, if there's any parents in here, like, those are all the things that I wanted to instill when I was raising my daughter, you know? But it was just kind of all lost on me. And I remember very distinctly, I remember what the folder looked like on that stupid mouth test, you know? And I remember it not even blinking, not even thinking for a minute, well, wait a minute, if I cheat and get 100, it's not really 100. And, you know, maybe I would feel better about myself with the 99 than I would if I was a liar and a cheat. But nope, didn't even enter into my mind. And, you know, and that's just kind of the way my mind worked through a lot of things. You know, I was an athlete and I had I was pretty intelligent and I had a lot of friends where I was raised. We all just kind of grew up together. And, you know, we all knew each other's business. We all played together, played sports together. We, you know, we hung out together. We did everything together. And I would make up these ridiculous stories about, like, who my biological family was. And it was just BS, crap. And I'm telling these stories to people that know all my business. So it's not, you know, they would just call my mom, fact check with my mom. And my mom would say, nope, I don't know why she told you that. So, you know, but I realize now that what I've learned through step work and through being willing to look at myself from an honest perspective is that our book even says that the deception of others is always rooted in the deception of myself. And the truth of the matter is the lies that I told back then, the lies that I've told, you know, throughout my entire life, they're fear-based and they're never about you. They're always to convince myself that I am something I'm not or that I'm not something I am. And, you know, and I was just super uncomfortable in my skin and just restless, irritable and discontent every minute of every day for as long as I can remember. And there weren't enough home runs and not enough trophies and not enough straight A's and not enough student council elections and whatever else I had going on. Because the truth is I did have all that going on. I was all those things. Now, prior to accurate inventory work and a real look at my past, I would have told you that I was some kind of, I don't know what, in school trying to look cool to you or whatever. But the truth is I had a really good childhood. There were some things that happened to me outside of my home that should not happen to a little girl. And, you know, and I don't know if that had, you know, but I remember that was after third grade. I remember cheating on that test before that should happen. But I would have told you that those things happening to me is why I behaved the way I behaved. And I would have told you that, you know, because I love to play that victim card. I love to be someone that life happened to me because I have to make everything about me. You know, there's a meditation that, thank you to my friends, Bill and Alan, my sponsor, Nicole, by the way, for being here too. But there's something that some of us all read this morning and it was talking about, I make a big deal out of myself or I make big deals. You know what I mean? Because I want everything to be about me. And prior to Alcoholics Anonymous and far into sobriety, that's still what I always did, you know? And, so I'll make that adoption crap about, you know, what's wrong with me. And when those things happened to me as a little girl with some older family members and stuff, I like that we read what we read because when I share some of the details, I'm going to share in a general way, but there are some details that I feel responsible to relate to you because there's some things that happened to me. And what I now know 25 years sober is that they happened to a lot of us. And my family, as great as they were, you don't talk about stuff. You don't seek help and you don't talk to people about that, especially if it's family related. Those are our secrets and our business and you don't get help and you don't talk to anybody about that stuff. And so I didn't. And, you know, and I now know that sometimes the worst experiences I have, the things that used to have their way with me and turn me into a less than human person who just sucked everything out of the people around me that I could possibly get from you and then moved on to the next. Those events have become some of my biggest assets because they're what make me effective and useful to you. You know, and so I'm willing to share them now more than I you know, ever thought I would be. But you know, those things happen to me and, simultaneously that screw in my gut that tightens and that voice in my head that's always nagging at me and always saying negative crap to me. It just got louder and the hole in my gut got bigger and you know, the things, the sports and the lies and the doing whatever and the self-centered behavior and the self-seeking and the stuff just stopped doing it for me. And somewhere around middle school, I grew up playing tackle football. I grew up on a cul-de-sac with my older brother and all his friends. And so I was quite the tomboy growing up. And, you know, middle school came around and all of a sudden being a really good athlete and playing, you know, tackle football with you became, well, first of all, it becomes not an option at that age. They stopped letting the girls play tackle football. But, you know, it just became an actual separation between me and my fellows. My girlfriends and stuff, they all seem to know how to transition into, you know, okay, now we don't punch boys in the arm, and now they start kissing boys and crap like that. And, you know, and all these, like, boy-girl parties started happening, and I just, that anxious apartness just grew and grew and grew because it became a reality, because I really didn't know how to act. I really didn't know how to relate to boys, like, you know, to my fellows at all, but to boys in particular, unless I'm playing sports with you, I don't know how to deal with you. And so it started to make me feel less than, and so I would start behaving in ways that were not who I were, but how I thought you wanted me to behave. And that became something that ruled my life far into sobriety, and all every minute up to it was trying to get you to see me the way I think I need to be seen. Was trying to get you. I was always trying to some unrealistic and unreasonable demands on my fellows to make me feel good. You know, I need you to feel a certain way about me and see me a certain way so that I can feel valuable. And I'm always seeking that from outside myself for as long as I can remember. And somewhere around eighth grade, I was at a party, and I would always go out of my way to, you know, like I would just wear ridiculous clothes and stuff like that I'd have to sneak out. I'd have to sneak out of my house and then change later because my mom and dad were not having that. And then I would change into some hoochie clothes, trying to get people to see me a certain way, you know. And the truth is, not, I wouldn't know what to do with you if you did behave that way toward me, but I'm trying to be, you know, it's not about how it is, it's about how it looks, right? And so, you know, I started doing that, and I would always hang out at my friend's house, and my friend Brenda, she was, you know, her mom killed herself when we were in the seventh grade, and so she had troubles, and so of course that's whose house I want to hang out at, because there's never anybody home, and she's all effed up, and you know, and she's sexually active. We're like 13, you know, and she's sexually active, and she's got this older boyfriend, and I think she's just the coolest thing in the world because of the way she behaves, and you know, and she's got me listening to cool music, and she cut her hair all off short, and I just thought she was the coolest thing, you know. And so we'd all tell lies, and like I would act like I was at, you know, Lynn's house, and Lynn would act like she was at Laura's house, and Laura would say she's at my house when really we're all at Brenda's house where none of us are supposed to be. You know, one night I did that, yet another time where I just tell a lie to get what I want and selfishly pursue what I think I need to have. You know, and the long story short is that her boyfriend and her were down the hall doing, you know, what they do in the bedroom. And his friend was talking to me and paying attention to me in a way that I thought that I needed to be paid attention to. And about Miller Genuine Draft number 3, I was slipped for hypnol and rape that night. And then my whole life changed. The attention to be honest, the attention I thought that I wanted, I got in a way I did not intend, and my whole life changed after that. I don't remember ever playing sports after that. I'm not organized anyway. All I know is that by the time I hit high school, there's no more student council, there's no more athlete of the year, there's no more scholastic achievement awards, there's none of that. It's just me getting high before school. And drinking, you know, every chance I can, because what I remembered was at those boy-girl parties, the Seagram's Wildberry Wine Cooler would shut that voice in my head up just a little bit so that I could hear, you know, other things, so that I could, you know, my ground sponsor says come out and play in a way that was comfortable to me. And I felt like I knew how to act, you know, when I had alcohol on board. And it didn't have to be alcohol. Drugs are a contributing factor to my alcoholism. But what makes me alcoholic and just to stick to singleness of purpose, which I already called out, you know, those things, I quit those things and switched those things and left them and took them and left them many, many times. But the alcohol was not something that I could just leave. When I'm not drinking is when this insanity begins for me. Because once I find a solution that quiets that voice in my head and fills that hole in my gut, why would I ever stop doing it? You know, to this day, I hear some of the readings we begin a lot of meetings with, and they talk about all the ways that we have tried to stop drinking. I didn't try to stop drinking. I didn't try to stop drinking. Like, I just didn't. And I don't want to drink like a gentleman. I have no desire to this day, nor have I ever want. I don't want to. Two sounds stupid to me. Drinking two drinks sounds like why would I want to just drink two drinks? Two drinks is where the magic starts to happen. And so, you know, I don't relate with trying to stop in all the ways that we said. I relate with not being able to stop. I relate with Oblivion. I'm not ever trying to get buzzed. I never was. I think that my favorite beer is whatever is in the beer bong with a funnel. You know, that's how you drink beer. And, you know, and hard alcohol is just so much more efficient, isn't it? And, you know, and Jack Daniels is, you know, probably the longest relationship I've ever been in my life. And I miss him terribly sometimes, you know. But what happened for me is, you know, that the obsession to do that has been removed. It's more likely, more exact for me is the obsession that drinking is going to do for me what I need it to do has been removed. So, you know, I ran around. I liked to chase boys in bands. It was the 80s. I live in LA, Sunset Strip. What can I say? That was just a cool thing to do at the time. And I hung out there a lot. I had a lot of cousins that were in bands, and I grew up going to clubs when I was a kid. I would say I was their drum technician or their guitar technician, so I could see live music from a very early age. Loved it. I still love it. But so I would, you know, I remember things were getting out of hand in my hometown. Nobody was really talking to me anymore. I would just drink and use all the time. I would take off and just disappear from my family. You know, they didn't know where I was at for, you know, weeks sometimes, and I would just resurface. They'd find me passed out, drunk in front of their house in my car. And, you know, and then they tried taking the car back away to try and prohibit that. And I never cared anything about how I looked to the neighbors, you know, how it must have looked for them as parents. I didn't care that they didn't know where I was. I, you know, to be honest, I behaved exactly like someone who just felt like they were lucky I came home at all. You know, I'm a mom now. I've got a 20-year-old daughter, and I can tell you the first time I couldn't find her in the house for 5 minutes, I thought I was going to, you know, lose it. And so the idea that I could, so I used to have this delusion that, like, in making all those amends and stuff that I could make up for all that, you know. And now I know as a parent, like, your kid's missing, man. I don't know if you can ever really make that square with your parents. I don't know. I just spend my life trying to earn what I have, I guess. But I don't know if it'll ever be even with my parents. But I didn't know where I was for a long time, and my drinking and using it had gotten completely out of hand. I couldn't be sober in any way, shape, or form for a long time. And, you know, the times that I was sober was because I was asleep for a few days, sleeping off whatever, you know, run I was just on. And, you know, one night I remember I met somebody and some bass player in a band at a club in Anaheim, and he said, "You should come see my band play in San Diego sometime." And I moved to San Diego that night. Which was not out of the ordinary for me. I like to be a free spirit. Really, I'm just a selfish ass that just, you know, takes off because I don't want to deal with the consequences of my actions here. I burned all my bridges here, and, you know, and I had bad things were happening. I had a friend shot and killed in front of me at a party. You know, things were starting to get real. It started to not, that lie I kept trying to tell myself about how I was just partying and having a good time at 21 years old started to be really hard to believe, you know, here. I thought it was because it was here. So I moved there, you know, and I thought that it was going to get better there. And it did for a minute. I became a band promoter down there. I had a very well-meaning business partner who asked me if I could stop doing all the other crap and just drink. And my drink, I got to see my drinking really clearly at that point, and it wasn't good. And I drank away that career in short order. And, you know, and the next thing you know, by the time I'm 24, you know, just about to turn 25, I'm living in people's garages, sort of, you know. I'm just staying wherever I can get access to. I'm like 96 pounds, which is not good for someone with my build. And I had gotten some abscess tooth or something where my face literally ruptured, and I had a hole on the side of my face. When I smoked cigarettes, the smoke would come out the side of my face. And when they tried to save my life, because what that was a ruptured abscess, and I almost died from it. I had poisons coursing through the veins of my body. I was in ICU for like 9 days, and they had to bust out a couple of teeth to get to where they needed to get to save my life. And, you know, so I was quite the vision for you. And I just turned 25, and I really still thought that I was only hurting myself. I thought that, you know, I had to start taking a long look at my life, and I'd gotten beaten up with a little Dodger bat. I had a really, the last few months of my drinking were not great. And I mean, it culminated with me getting arrested in a vacant house. And I remember when I got arrested, you know, there had been suicide attempts, some of which were really, I wanted to die, most of which were just, please somebody do something about this mess. And I had all that, and I didn't have any idea with my big brain and everything that people stopped drinking. I couldn't put the two things together. I didn't know people got sober. I knew that other stuff was out of line, because I mean, who does that? It's not like people, you know, show up wasted and on drugs and crap at Christmas or something. But alcohol's normal, right? Everybody does that. I just need to like lay off the Jack Daniels and maybe just drink beer out of a funnel, of course, but still. And you know, and these are the things that I think, you know, other than that, that was like all the thought I ever gave it. Like I told you a little while ago, I don't want to have two. I don't want to get buzzed. I want oblivion or dead, really. Like that was kind of all I was shooting for by that point. And when I got arrested that night, or that, I don't even know if it was day or night, there was a dog barking in my face, a drug dog, and they had me handcuffed sitting in a chair. And they had us for trespassing and under the influence of any number of things, including alcohol. And this dog was barking in my face. And all I remember thinking was, thank God someone's going to do something about this now, you know? And little did I know, I was right on the money with that, because what happened is I got sentenced to, that was in June of 94. I got sentenced to 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and some outpatient program thing. So I remember going to a meeting in San Diego, and all I remember about that meeting was someone telling me to say I'm an alcoholic. Some well-meaning person next to me, or maybe not so well-meaning as I now know, but told me, just say you're an alcoholic and tell them your name. And I remember standing up and saying that with no connection, no belief that I was, didn't even know what that meant. I said it because I live and die by what you think of me. And if you're going to think I don't fit in, I'm going to say it. And so I said it. And at the end, I remember the kind of the prayer out. And otherwise, I don't remember anything about that meeting. My court date was in October. So, of course, in September, I moved back home with mom and dad to complete the other 9 meetings I was supposed to do and that program thing that was due in a month. And because that's how I roll. And, you know, and I mentioned that I'm a failure to appear kind of girl, because here's why that's relevant. I don't know why I showed up. I don't show up for court dates. I don't show up for anything. I don't show up for Christmas. I don't show up for jobs. I don't show up for stuff. And, you know, and I don't know why when I got arrested that day, they released me the next day. I didn't have to go back. It's not like I had some residence or anything. I mean, I didn't live anywhere, and they would have never found me. But I ended up in Vista, California, and I showed up in court there. And, you know, and I don't know why. And I also don't know why I did the sentence that they gave me. No earthly idea, because I don't do that. And, you know, and so what ended up happening is I came here and I showed up at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at a place called Cider House in Norwalk, California. And my whole life changed that night. A gentleman who is sponsored by my grand sponsor named Steve M. He was the secretary of that meeting. Turns out he was fairly new. I didn't know that at the time. He told the then railroaded literature guy, this guy named Michael, who is one of the closest people to me. He's married to my sponsor. He told him to front me a big book for $1 a week. And I did that. And I came back every week and I paid that stupid dollar. And, you know, and thank God I still have that big book to this day. And it's got step work outlined in it. And it said, nobody told me to wait and get comfortable. Nobody told me to, you know, to sit around until I feel like I might be one of them and then start working the steps. They just wrote it out for me right there in the book and said, get started, you know. I didn't have a sponsor, so one of those people told me, like, you know, who do you hear in your head? It was a guy named Redheaded Dave, and they said, well, there's your sponsor. And I said, no, it has to be a woman, right? And they said, who is it? Show me in the book where it says that. And what you need to do, honey, before you kill yourself trying to do this the way you think everyone wants you to do it, is just do the deal. That shit will sort itself out. And so, and that proved to be true for me, because Redheaded Dave did not care one bit what I thought or felt about anything. He cared a little. Mostly he cared what I did, though. He would take a minute and say, oh, honey, I know how you feel. Now get busy. He cared way more about what I did. And he taught me very early on that my thoughts and feelings are not anything I can control, and they do not dictate, you know, the right next step. What does is my actions. He told me that I didn't have to believe in a higher power. I just had to, you know, turn something over to someone that wasn't my big brain, and that I'd probably be just fine. And, you know, and he let me find my alcoholism in that book. He let me find my identification by taking me through the book. You know, I had reservations. I thought that other stuff was what was really the problem, you know. But once I really looked at my drinking, it turns out that, you know, from 13 to 25, I have never stopped drinking until something interceded. Something has to stop me from drinking. Either it's because I can't get any more when I was a kid, or, you know, I get busted, excuse me, or, you know, or I pass out, or I just run out of it, whatever. Something, I've never uttered the words, that's cool, I'm good. It's just not who I am. You know, I don't get to a point where I feel really good right now. I think I'm going to stop. That's not a reality for me. I don't know what that's like. I don't do that. I see my mom do it all the time. I don't roll like that. What ends up happening for me is, you know, utter debacle and total chaos. And then, you know, maybe I'll stop, or I'll start doing something else that sobers me up. And then I'll just start again once I start feeling uncomfortable. So I found myself in that book, and thank God I did. And I got really active, really busy, really quickly, because that's what I was taught to do. You know, thank God I didn't have someone, you know, I can't tell anyone else to do, but I have the floor and this is my experience. But if someone would have told me that it was okay for me to wait until I felt comfortable, you'd have a different speaker, because I'd be dead. You know, I was not spoon fed this thing. I was here they are, go, you know, and I thought they were written in past tense because it meant everyone else in the room had already done that in those steps, you know, and I was never treated like the steps and the traditions were an option for me. Like I could just, you know, put the plug in the jug and go to meetings, meetings, meetings. Although there were plenty of meeting makers who, you know, I guess made it, whatever, all around me telling me that, you know, meeting attendance was key and all that stuff, and not talking about the steps, you know. But thank God I had a, you know, divine intervention. So they say, I had providence, like stuff that was provided for me that was beyond my ability, including showing up at that court date and showing up at those meetings. You know, I completed all that stuff and I got really busy. And so by the time I had my first year, I was well into my amends. And, you know, I started to make amends to people and, you know, under direction. I had one amends that before I came back to LA, when I had just done that one meeting where I lied and said I was an alcoholic and then don't remember anything else, there was someone I had treated really badly, an ex-boyfriend, and I treated him and his family horribly. I owed him money. And it was really bothering me. And so because it was bothering me and I felt bad, I had the urgent need to apologize and have him forgive me so I could feel better, you know. And I sought him out and I made it so much worse by, I don't know, I just told some bunch of self-centered crap and demonstrated no remorse whatsoever or no change whatsoever. And I made it really bad. And that turned out to be the amends that took 10 years for me to find that person again, because I had botched it so badly trying to do it on my own self-will, you know. And so what ended up happening for me is I got to about 2 years sober and I had a bunch of legal amends. When I say I'm a failure to appear kind of girl, I'm not exaggerating. I literally had 6-7 warrants, all of which were for failures to appear, many on a suspended license where all I had to do was show up and it wouldn't have been a big deal, but I don't show up. And so I ended up having all these nuisance little things. And so I couldn't drive. I couldn't drive for almost 3 years sober. I couldn't do much of anything. So I had this crappy little job behind the counter at the Alano Club that, I got sober running around and, you know, and they paid a lot of those amends off. I remember going to my parents, first thing, that was like before I had a year, and, telling them, you know, the amends that my sponsor and I sat down and worked out. And, you know, and I remember they gave me the line that so many of us get. And if you're new and you haven't got to this step yet, you're probably not going to want to hear what I'm going to say, but. And I remember them telling me, oh, honey, we don't care about the money. We don't care about any of that stuff. We just want you to do good. We just want you to keep doing what you're doing. You know, I mean, these are people who had set me up with chores and an allowance so that I could smoke cigarettes, put gas money in the tank of people who were taking me to meetings, and have Seventh Tradition money because they cared that much. They just wanted me to go to whatever I was going to that was saving my life. That's all they knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all they cared about. And, you know, and so they sincerely did not care about the money, I thought. And so when I went back to my sponsor and said, oh, good news, you know, all that money I have saved up, I get to keep it because they don't want my money. They just want me to keep doing well. And some of you are laughing because you know that what he told me was, it doesn't matter. You're still going to give them the money. And, you know, I'll tell you something funny about my sweet little loving parents. The first check I wrote, they snatched it right out of my hands and cashed it the next day. They had no calls. And they knew precisely how much money I owed them because they had a record of it. They were keeping tabs the whole time. So, You know, and then on top of that, I had to, I fixed my teeth on their dime too. So I had to pay that back too. But, so anyway, so that started that. And you know, and I'm so glad I went down that way because the truth is that started to show me how to be accountable. You know, I think I made $30 a day working behind the counter of that Alano club. And because, and this has been my experience here, when I'm willing, what I need will show up, you know? And so what ended up happening was I started, I met some lady, and the reason I met her is because, she was some old timer at the club and they were all going, camping or something. And I had knocked out most of my little penny ante amends and, but I had this really big warrant coming up and it was a failure to appear on a failure to appear issued on a suspended license. That was my third suspension with notice after a failure to appear. I swear to you. And so, and it was a mandatory $10,000 or 30 days in jail. And, that was the last one I had. And I took this little job babysitting this old timer's cat and dogs, while she went camping one weekend. And I had never been to her house. I'm reading the names of these animals off a cheat card, you know, as I'm walking through her house. And I did that. I just fed her animals for a weekend, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me. And it was going to give me an extra $50. And, you know, I was self-supporting by that time. And so I did what, you know, the next indicated step was. And what ended up happening is when that lady returned, she ended up needing someone to work in her office. She had a tax service and bookkeeping business that she had run out of her home for a number of years. And she needed someone to work at it. And so I started working for her. And, you know, and then I started going to college because I had a really good aptitude for that field of work. And, you know, and then right around the same time I had had a I had that big sense hanging over me. And so what ended up happening is, I was going to pay, I earned the money and I was going to pay it all out and, pay off the, some of this fine. And then I was going to do some weekends in jail or something. And long story short, I ended up turning myself in. I was coming up on 3 years sober and I turned myself in, to the court and I just decided to do the time. You know, it was going to get reduced down to 10 days because of overcrowding or some nonsense. I don't know. I'm trying to talk like really good jail talk right now. I don't know. This is the only time I've ever been in jail is what I'm about to tell you. So, but what ended up happening is I go to court and, I'll be honest, I went into that courtroom and I had some money in my pocket and an unopened pack of cigarettes and all stuff that all my jail friends had, you know, prepped me for. And I had my sponsor in the courtroom and my employer, my family knew what I was doing and everybody was behind me on this amends. And when I turned myself into that judge and he read all these letters I had and read my case and my documents, what I expected to happen was what I had heard from the podium a bunch of times and stuff. And what I believed a spiritual experience to be about at that time, I expected him to say, oh, well, you're almost 3 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. You're a good member of society and you're active. Go with God, child. And that's what I thought was going to happen. Right. And instead what happened is he said, bailiff, take her into custody. And they put the cuffs on me. And man, was I pissed. Peace cracking up over there. I was so mad. And I remember sitting in that courtroom handcuffed and feeling exactly like I felt that night that I got arrested in that house and that dog was barking at me. Only I was not relieved. I was pissed. And I remember thinking all that time, I was like, A is a lie. This is a bunch of crap. All of the speakers were full of just absolute crap. They're up there talking about all this stuff. That's podium stories and fluff. And this is unicorns and rainbows. I knew it, you know, and I started going down the list and taking all of your inventory and like, you're doing this and you're doing that. And this person's walking around free and they've been driving the whole time. They don't have a license. And I'm just going down the list of how God's picking on me, you know, and F this higher power. I don't even believe in that stuff anyway. And I was so angry. And I remember they're transporting me to jail and the whole time I cannot believe this is happening to me. Right. And they're so angry. And then when they're processing me in, the guards start calling me cover girl and crap because, you know, I smiled when they took my picture because I'm not a criminal anymore. I mean, I am obviously, but you know, and they gave me these big floppy shower sheets. And I inadvertently, when they asked me why I was there, I said, I turned myself in. So then I got a cavity check, which you don't even want to know about. It was all bad. And, you know, and I was so angry and I was just eaten up with resentment and fear. And I remember sitting in my cell and, you know, cursing God, like, how could you do this to me? I did everything you've asked me to do. I've gone to any lengths. I've done everything and blah, 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 which of course probably wasn't true. I'm pretty sure I wasn't an angelic newcomer, but anyway, but it's my story. And I'm sitting in the, in the cell, and I'm waiting for my cellie to come in and make me her, you know what, because that's just what I've been told jail's like, or I think I'm in a prison movie all of a sudden. And I remember this girl, Laura Holt, came in, and she was 7 months pregnant, so she came waddling in. We were in a little pod jail, so we're just the two of us in this little spot. And she came waddling in all pregnant, and she was like, what are you in for? And that was the one question I didn't want, because I didn't want to look like a sissy, you know? And I'm like, oh, I turned myself in. But that's what I said, you know? And I told, and she's like, why would you do that? And I said, well, I'm trying to change my life, you know? I've been living this way for a long time, and now I just, you know, I want something different. And I asked her what she was in for, and she told me that she had been arrested for drug trafficking charges and was awaiting extradition to Colorado. And that as soon as she had that baby, they were going to take it from her, and she was never going to see it again because she had already had two kids that her mother had taken on, and that this baby was going into the system because her mom was no longer willing to take on her daughter's stuff, and that she would never see the baby again. And then she said the thing that changed my entire life, and she said, I've tried to get clean and sober, but nothing works. And in that moment, after I firmly heard my head pop out of my rear end, I remember realizing that the reason I was sitting in that cell was because it's not about me. I was sitting in that cell to talk to that girl for the next 10 days or however long I would end up serving. And that's exactly what I did. I 12-stepped that girl. I ended up being more like 4 days. But I remembered from in that moment, this girl who cannot function without everyone thinking that I'm perfect and that I'm great, you know, that I live and die by your opinions of me. I do whatever I think that you want me to do so I will fit in. And I'll tell you, I was doing that in Alcoholics Anonymous too. Now, I happen to be doing it the way of following the steps and doing what my sponsor told me to do because I wanted everyone to like me, and that ended up saving my life. But in that moment, there was no audience. There was nobody looking. It was just me and that girl. And I realized in that moment that I believed all the things I was doing. And I realized in that moment that, I really was willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. And that feeling that I was too messed up for this to work for me, that I had carried that first 3 years in sobriety, that feeling like the God thing was going to be an issue because I don't believe in that stuff. That feeling like, you know, at any minute now, just like my whole childhood, everyone in AA is going to find out that I'm a liar and that I'm a fraud. You know, I had that feeling every minute that I was sober. I never thought this thing was going to work for me. I just kept doing it anyway because that's what I was taught to do. It didn't matter as much what I thought and felt. It mattered what I did. And so I just kept doing that. In that moment, in that jail cell, I knew that. I knew that all to be true. And so 4 days later, when I got released from that place, I was waiting for my ride to come and pick me up. And I remember for the first time in my life, knowing that I could stay sober for the rest of my life, knowing that I was truly willing to go to any lengths and that I was legitimately doing this thing and it didn't matter what anyone else thought about me. And I've never had the obsession, like I mentioned a little while ago, that alcohol was going to do for me what I needed it to do for me. I've never had it ever again. And so when I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, not too long after that, me and some friends formed my home group. We started we heard about these things called traditions, and we started to investigate that and see what that was about. My sobriety got very different. My sobriety got to be more about sponsorship and sponsoring, and it got to be more about a home group that believed what I believed about singleness of purpose. Before that, I was that girl that ran around going, drugs, alcohol, it doesn't matter. It only says alcohol in the first step because I didn't know any better. There weren't people talking traditions when I was new. And I went out and I learned about that and I found out, you know, why that matters, that it can kill people to act like they're all the same, like anything's the same. I was in a meeting this morning. They were talking about being in an open meeting and someone was anorexic and I was like, oh, cool, whatever. It doesn't matter. And I remember my friend Billy saying something to me a long time ago about what if I had gone into, what if that cider house meeting I went to, what if instead I accidentally wandered into a Gamblers Anonymous meeting? Because it was a 12-step meeting, right? And that's just where I went. And those gamblers had told me, oh, it's okay. You don't have a gambling problem, honey. It's all the same. Only the first step says anything about gambling, right? But I'm not a gambler. And there's no way that if I can't concede at some point that I have what you have, like what you guys read at the beginning of your meeting, there's no way I'm going to do what you do. There's no way I'm going to turn myself in to go to jail. Go to jail sober? Are you off your nut? Like, no way. You think I'm going to turn my will and my life over? And do all the things that you say I'm going to do, and maybe I never get all the stuff I want? Why would I do that? You know, You know, and plus I'm the kind of person with a big ego, and this big brain of mine will tell me all the time that I am, you know, that I'm the smartest person in the room, and I'll just get real, real busy living the life AA gives me, and I will forget how I got it. You know, my problem has never been when my ass is on fire or somebody's, you know, somebody dies. You know, when my dad died, I didn't for a second think, I got this. I don't need to go to meetings. I don't need a higher power, all that stuff. So my dad died. It was everything to me, right? But man, I go a few weeks or a few months with no problems, and I get a raise at work, and things are going good, and my kid gets some award at school. I don't, you know, I got no problem believing that I don't need to go to meetings, and that stuff creeps up on me real fast, and it'll still do it to this day, you know. I will grow laurels really quickly if I don't stay connected on a daily basis. If I don't remember everything I just told you about, if I don't remember, you know, I hate that I, if I always used to joke around about if I had gotten sober a few months later, I wouldn't have this ugly scar on my face. But I'm so glad I have it, because every time I go like this, I remember, you know. I need those reminders, because success is what messes with an alcoholic like me. You know, and resentment isn't what takes me out either. Resentment's not the number one offender for someone like me. Fear is. Fear is the thing that'll have me start lying again and trying to put myself, like, in a position to look good rather than be good. You know, I get real lost with success and looking like I'm managing well and all that kind of crap. You know, and I get real fear-based, too. I start worrying about what people are going to think. What if I stand up for what I think is right and someone doesn't like it? You know, and these are the reasons why I got to stay connected. I have to sponsor people. I have to be sponsored. You know, I have to have people I'm willing to be who I am with. And you know, maybe I get rejected, maybe I don't, but at least I'm not, you know, being something that I'm not, because that being something I'm not in the pursuit of that is what tried to take me out when I was a kid. And it's what made me put all that crap in me every minute of every day for as long as I could, because I can't stand the idea that, you know, that all I'm left with is me and I don't think I'm sufficient, you know? And I don't know where that comes from. Like I said, I wasn't raised that way. It wasn't my life experience early on, but there's just something in my head that always tells me I'm not good enough. There's something in my head that always tells me that, you know, that, yeah, you're messed up too, but I'm more messed up than you. And what I know now is that's that thing I mentioned at the beginning of, I have to have, everything's got to be a big deal, because that's the only way that I can keep it about me. If I'm the worst in the room, it's about me. If I'm the best in the room, it's about me. If I get 100 instead of 99, then I'm the best and you have to like me because I'm the best, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous and the pursuit of being useful and effective to other people has replaced all of that most of the time, but only because I tap into it every day. Every day, you know, there's a thing in our book that says God is either everything or else he is nothing. And a lot of people stop at that, and I hate it, because the next line for me is where the money's at. What was my choice to be? Because I have a choice. I have the freedom to choose. I can run my own life today, and maybe it'll be okay, and maybe it won't. Just like when I used to drink, sometimes it was okay. Most of the time it wasn't. What was my choice to be? So, you know, most days, almost every day, I choose to at least, I don't care if it's 5 minutes sitting out there having a conversation with my higher power. That's me saying, okay, God, you're not nothing. You know, okay, I can, you know what I mean? I can see that maybe you've got a better plan. Because the truth of the matter is, what I now know about a higher power that I had no intention of believing in when I got here is that he knows my heart and he has a plan. You know, and that's really all I need to know or understand about it. That my version, as much as I think we're all going to be happy in my version, because I've written the script like very distinctly where it all works out, all of us getting what we want. The truth is, I don't know. My ego will tell me that I know what's best for me. It'll tell me that I know what's best for you, and I will act accordingly. So if I can check my ego and agree at the beginning of each day that I'm not in charge, it makes things go a lot smoother for everyone, including myself. You know, what I ask my higher power every day is to fill the hearts of the people in my life today, and don't let anything I do or fail to do get in the way of that. And most days are pretty good. You know, I think that most of the people in my life will tell you that they know that they're important to me because my actions dictate to them that they're important to me. You know, my sponsor knows she's my sponsor because I am sponsorable and teachable. And I don't just say, I know all the time, you know, or report to her the facts after they've occurred. You know, I'm willing to concede that this big brain of mine is not always on my side. You know, my thought life is placed on a much higher plane when my thinking is cleared of wrong motives. Go figure. You know, and I've had this incredibly good life, here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if I deserve it, but I just work to earn it every day because I don't know nothing about what I deserve and what I don't deserve. I think that asks my higher power to judge me. And if I feel like I got a higher power that judges me, I'm not sure that I'm going to trust him with my stuff because I'm going to screw stuff up. I screw something up at least once every day. And if I don't feel safe and comfortable turning that over to a higher power and telling the people in my life, hey, I'm a flawed human being, I'm screwed. Like, it'll just be that stupid 100% on that damn mouth piss every day of my life, like Groundhog Day, And so I just accept that there's people in my life that care about me. There's people in my life that I care about. I sponsor to the best of my ability. I carry the message because it was carried to me. And I just stay busy, and it's miraculous because the busier I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more time I have to do Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a great job. I have a family. I suit up and show up in every area of my life today. And nobody, I don't believe, feels like they're getting gypped except for maybe my mother. But I'm guessing that everyone's mother thinks that they don't call enough or do enough. But, and I'm working on that. That's an active amends that I'm working on. I just spent all day yesterday working on it because that relationship isn't what I want it to be. And I want to make damn sure it's not a part of mine because I'm not doing something, that I should be doing. And so I suit up and I show up and I do what is suggested to me in prayer and meditation and from the guidance of a sponsor who I trust and tell the truth to. And I do that every day. And I just, leave the results up to something bigger than me. I'm not capable of processing who deserves what or what the results are supposed to be or getting all caught up in that. My job is just to take the next right step, and today I'm really privileged and honored and so happy that my next right step was to show up with you guys today. I really, really would love to attend this meeting in person someday when the world goes back on its axis. And thank you so much for having me. And again, happy anniversary to your group. Thank you.